publicly unravel. Their grandfather, who was much more their father figure, die of a heart attack at 63. And Bridget, their nanny, who was much more their mother figure, die of a heart attack at 67. Their dad's sex life was thrown in their faces, and his mistress, who they didn't much like at all, was now expecting another baby, while the press hounded them throughout. A wedding date still had not been set by the time Marla went into labor in October 1993. It was her first, Donald's fourth, but different for him in every imaginable way. Don Jr. came into the world before Ivana had even time for an epidural. Ivana had time enough to shoo her husband out of the room for fear he'd never want to sleep with her again. Donald had not protested much, given the profoundness of his germophobia. Much was the same when Ivanka and Eric were born. He stayed clear until they were all cleaned up and Ivana had time to make herself look presentable again. Second wives often have the benefit of a softer version of the man their first wife married, a man beaten down by vows kept and those deserted, who's reflected on what he missed the first go-around and how he'd do it over again if he could. If the man is successful and the woman younger and more beautiful, as tends to happen, particularly in New York, the women have leverage. Sure, the men have the outward-facing power, but the women, in their own way, own their husbands, too. Marla was not yet a wife, despite the traveling wedding gown and Donald's own internal pressure cooker ticking away, but when she went into labor, she knew full well Donald was going to be there whether he wanted to or not. And Donald, who'd missed out on the births of his eldest three kids, complied. He was in New York when Marla's water broke at Mar-a-Lago at 2 o'clock in the morning. An hour later, he boarded his plane bound for the hospital Marla had chosen in Palm Beach. By 6 o'clock, he was by Marla's side in the delivery room. Perhaps he should have chosen Don Jr.'s light-speed delivery instead. Marla was in labor for 10 hours, and as someone who prided herself on spirituality, she turned the birthing suite into a full-blown New Age wonderland. Candles were lit all around the room. New Age music played softly in the background. She invited her manager's fiancé, a Native American who called herself a nurturer, to give massages and send prayers to help make the birthing process more peaceful for mom and baby. "Pray for me now," Marla would shout as a contraction neared. Donald was a wreck. Marla's mother, Anne, and her closest friend were in the room, too, trying to settle things down, to keep things as calm as possible for Marla and make sure Donald did not run away or blow all the candles out in frustration. He could not stand all the hippy-dippy stuff Marla was into, one longtime friend remembered. It infuriated him, particularly when it came to his child. You have to remember, this is a man who ate steak and potatoes and heaps of ice cream and fast food and can after can of Coke. You think he cared about his kid being brought into the world with Native American prayers and candlelight? What he wanted was the OBGYN to give Marla drugs. Strong drugs. Drugs that might make her stop all that screaming because all of it was freaking him out. "I was very nervous because she was in a lot of pain," Donald said. "I tried to convince her to take something, but she wouldn't. I asked the doctor to convince her, but he knew Marla was determined not to take any drugs. She's so strong, such a strong woman, I'm amazed." Marla added that she and Donald did a lot of kissing while I was delivering, and once the baby was born, it was Donald who cut the umbilical cord. The other thing about a second wife, or mother of your child in this case, is that this go-around, you may get to name your child something your first spouse rejected. Donald had built his beloved Trump Tower after he secured the air rights over Tiffany & Company, the famed jewelry store next door, for $5 million. "Everything involved with Trump Tower has been successful," he told the Times, "and Trump Tower was built with Tiffany's air rights. But I've also always loved the name." Tiffany was the name Donald tried to give Ivanka when she was born, but Ivana shot down his suggestion immediately. Tiffany Ariana Trump, a 7.5-pound, blue-eyed, blonde-haired little girl, was born in the early afternoon of October 13th at St. Mary's Hospital in Palm Beach. Donald called a reporter at the New York Times 20 minutes after Tiffany was born. "We have a perfect little girl, a combination in looks of both of us, to go with my three other wonderful children," he said. With Marla relenting to his long-favored name, would he relent to Marla's request that they get married, especially with a new little baby Trump in the picture? Donald paused at the Times reporter's question. That is something being seriously contemplated. He was being quite honest. Even after Tiffany's birth, he had his doubts and his moments of conviction, neither of which stuck around for very long, each of which could easily replace another in his head. Marla had been loyal, but his family wasn't crazy about her. Tiffany deserved a father and a mother together, but he couldn't go through with that kind of divorce battle and near financial ruin he'd just barely crawled out of again. The should I or shouldn't I indecisiveness that plagued Donald Trump, that continues to plague Donald Trump today, would have gone on forever if not for a red line drawn by Marla, a second line drawn by his business advisors, and, to a lesser extent, a mass shooting close to home that finally pushed him over. Marla, who'd settled into life at Mar-a-Lago with her mother as a doting nanny and Marla whisperer for Donald after Tiffany was born, delivered her man an ultimatum. Either he married her by Christmas, or she would take his daughter and move out. She'd had enough. She was not going to spend another Christmas with Donald at Mar-a-Lago or anywhere without a wedding band on her finger. Marla wasn't even living with Donald full-time in New York. He lived part of the time in his Trump Tower apartment below the triplex, sometimes staying with her in the Trump Park apartment. It wasn't the way she was going to raise her daughter, with a sometimes daddy who refused to marry her mother out of fear of losing his money and a desire to chase tail around town. Anne, who wanted the wedding perhaps even more than Marla, did what she could to assuage Donald's concerns with the financial side of things. Marla was resisting signing a prenup a month after Tiffany was born. Forget the money, which, of course, she couldn't. She knew full well that with a premarital agreement like that came a subsequent non-disclosure agreement. She didn't want to let go of the power that came from being able to tell the secrets Donald most cared about keeping close. Without that, what power could she wield over him? But it was a non-starter for Donald to marry Marla without one. A prenuptial agreement is a horrible document, he told Vanity Fair. When you're a believer in positive thinking, it isn't good. But it's a modern-day necessity. By late November, Marla relented. Donald wore down further under pressure from his advisors. They had a plan in the works to take his casinos public early the next year, and they didn't want Donald's personal life bandied about in the tabloids, as they knew it would be if he didn't give Marla the wedding she wanted. No sane investors would put their money into a company whose CEO's sex life made front-page news for weeks on end. We had to tell him over and over again to settle down, one advisor said. He would say, I know, I had to do it. It's the right thing to do. But they all knew that only made matters harder. When a New York man pulled out his Ruger P-89 9mm handgun on a Long Island Railroad train as it pulled into the Garden City station at about 6 p.m. on December 7th, walking backward down the aisle and staring passengers in the eyes as he fired 30 shots, Donald knew what he had to do. In the days that followed, authorities said 6 people had died and 19 were left injured. I figure life is short, Donald said in the aftermath, which it is, though it is unclear why this tragedy struck so close to home. It's hard to imagine that Donald himself ever commuted at rush hour on an LIRR train. Nevertheless, on the morning of December 10th, Donald told the New York papers he would marry Marla in a ceremony before Christmas. Marla sprang into action. She had been furiously trying to lose the baby weight for weeks just in case. Carolina Herrera was making her dress, and she had her first fitting for the gown exactly 2 months after Tiffany was born. At 5'10", she weighed 151 pounds by the middle of October, and knowing that just maybe her ultimatum and the internal and external pressures on Donald might make him cave, she started a strict diet to slim down to wedding shape as quickly as possible. It was all seeds and vegetables and raw nuts and greens and fruits all the time. Nothing in excess, she told Vanity Fair. Breastfeeding helped, too. She fed Tiffany just about anywhere she pleased around Mar-a-Lago, in the dining room for breakfast, by the pool in the afternoons. One longtime guest of the private club remembers Mar-a-Lago staffers delivering Marla a breast pump on a silver platter as she bronzed herself on a lounge chair tilted toward the sun. A few days before her fitting, she was down to 127 pounds. If she was extra strict, she would reach the 125-pound mark she had stuck in her head by the time she walked into Herrera on December 13th. The wedding was set for December 20th, which gave the designer less than a week to come up with a dress worthy of a Trump wedding and the circus this Trump wedding in particular would command. It was not going to be the dress she lugged around in her suitcase over the last year. That dress was immediately discarded after she got the official green light, Donald's credit card, and an appointment with Ms. Herrera, who made clothes for British royals and American ones, namely the Kennedys. Marla waltzed into her salon and chose double-faced satin from the famed Maison Boucault, a luxe fabric house in Lyon that's been spinning its yarns for nearly a century, in bright white, belying the fact that their baby Tiffany would herself be there for the wedding, in a mini designer dress of her own inlaid with pearls. The sleeves were cut off the shoulder with a slight sweetheart neck and bodice fit close to her chest, leaving little of Donald's favorite feature to the imagination. Down the back ran little traditional fabric-covered buttons leading to more white satin that fell in a removable train, which she could take off after the ceremony for the reception. She chose a very of-the-moment, vertically voluminous tulle veil that she found in the Carolina Herrera shop. For shoes, she went with Manolo Blahnik. Donald's tuxedo was sorted. He would wear Brioni, as he always did. He was far more concerned with who would actually show up to see Marla in white. There was no time for proper engraved invitations. There was no time for an official invitation at all, in fact. On the day Marla went to fit her dress, Donald's assistant started working the phones. It was a week before the big day, which would take place just before Christmas in New York. The A-list celebrities and big-time moguls Donald wanted there to watch his soon-to-be second wife walk down the aisle were busy or out of town or simply turned off by the spectacle of it all. Some would call it more on the charade end of spectacle, which enticed some of the more gossip-minded members of the Trump Rolodex to come anyway, and steered the more discerning away. Michael Jackson, Liza Minnelli, Whitney Houston, they all declined. So did his three older children. Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric opted to stay with their mother, who, as usual, was spending the final weeks of the year in Aspen, where they'd watched their parents' marriage unravel and caught a glimpse of their father's bride-to-be for the first time 4 years earlier. In a statement a representative faxed to the media, they said, "In discussion among ourselves, we decided to stay in Aspen with our mother and grandmother." On the night before his big day, it was Ivana he sent a dozen red roses to. Ivana, however, had brought her younger Italian boyfriend along for the trip. Together, they spent December 20th with Donald's children while Donald and Marla entered the Plaza Hotel, the place once managed by Ivana, to say I do. With a week's notice, Donald got 1,100 people to file into the plaza on that Saturday evening, from New York Mayor David Dinkins to Senator Al D'Amato, Bianca Jagger and Robin Leach, Howard Stern and Rosie O'Donnell, O.J. Simpson and Susan Lucci, Carl Icahn and Randall Cunningham, Don King, Evander Holyfield and Joe Frazier. Some made a quick entrance out of professional courtesy, like billionaire Ron Perlman, who was spotted arriving at the last second and calling for his car a few minutes later. As Donald feared, the final guest list lacked the heavy hitters he and others at the affair had expected. "It's just like I was afraid of," Howard Stern told reporters that evening. "I'm the biggest name here. I don't see any big stars." The ceremony took place in the hotel's mezzanine, where they'd constructed an altar covered in white orchids and birches, from which cut glass teardrops cascaded. As the New York Times vows column the next day noted, other than those teardrops, as the writer Julie Baumgold remarked after the ceremony, there wasn't a wet eye in the place. Though perhaps no one else felt it, Marla radiated in what she called all the warmth in the room. For her, it was about looking out and seeing our friends and family that have been there through everything with us. reading from the prophet, just holding his hand tight and knowing we were home. Fred Trump, Donald's father, who'd never much cared for Marla, served as Donald's best man. Janie Elder, whose name Marla had often assumed when she was in hiding as Donald's mistress during the chaos following his divorce from Ivana, was the maid of honor. A singer from the Metropolitan Opera sang throughout the ceremony, and a reverend from the Marble Collegiate Church, where Ivana and Donald had married and Marla and Donald flirted during their affair, performed the traditional vows. After they promised to be there for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, for richer and for poorer, to death do them part, the 1,000 people looking on broke into a round of applause. It was all a big show after all, and everyone there had a prime seat witnessing a moment in a very specific sort of modern American history. He's our P.T. Barnum, longtime Spy magazine and Vanity Fair editor, and Trump foe, Graydon Carter said of Donald that evening. This is the triumph of romance over finance. Mayor Dinkins had a rosy view of what he'd just witnessed to share with reporters. The bride was a vision in white, Mayor Dinkins told reporters. Donald just beamed. It was a lovely, lovely ceremony. Once it was all said and done, Fred Trump lifted up Marla's veil, revealing her baby face and a $2 million tiara she borrowed from Harry Winston, all of its 325 diamonds flashing in unison. Donald winked at Marla, his wife, before planting a faint little kiss on her cheek. The following morning, every New York paper put the affair on its front page, including the New York Times, all with the same raised eyebrow and snark in their tone that revelers had adopted the night before. The bride is taking her husband's name, the gray lady said in its vows column. The bridegroom is keeping his name, the Donald, a legacy from his former wife, Ivana. The snark was not unnecessary. Marriage is no great healer. It's not even a band-aid. So the wounds from their courtship continued to bleed long after they said I do, or perhaps because they had. Donald never wanted to be married. He'd been pressured to marry a woman he lusted after but didn't really love. As his one longtime friend reminded, the only person Donald ever really loved was Donald, and the rest were just accessories who, for a period of time, piqued his interest or served his needs. Marla expected the kind of loving husband and doting father Donald had never been and never would be. The gaps between what they each wanted had led them to break up and make up ad nauseam before the wedding. But legally bound as they now were, they instead fought about everything. Marla's new age inclinations irked Donald to no end. Tiffany's birth was just the start. Friends recall that Marla would take her Jeep, her car choice alone annoyed Donald, up to a property he owned in Westchester to be one with nature. She would tell him she was going up to gaze at the stars and look at the moon and spend the night out there, and he fucking hated it, one friend recalled. Part of him maybe didn't trust that she was going up there alone, but part of him just despised the fact that that is how she wanted to spend her time. Donald, all steak and potatoes and meatloaf and fast food, balked at Marla's habit of mostly ordering things in various shades of green when they went out to dinner. At Mar-a-Lago, she would brew a special tea that Donald looked at with disgust. I would never drink that, he'd see at her. That she was passing that on to their daughter sent him into a rage. She didn't even like Tiffany to have whole milk, and she was married to my dad, who's like the biggest pig ever, a real McDonald's guy, Ivanka said in an interview in 2000. I remember once he bought a Big Mac for Tiffany, and Marla said, "Don't give her that, she likes carrots." So my dad ended up waving the Big Mac and a carrot in front of Tiffany and asking her which one she wanted, and she picked the Big Mac. The Trumps intervened when Marla hesitated to get Tiffany vaccinated. Donald's sister Marianne went ballistic. She called Donald's closest friends, begging them to talk sense into him. "The baby's health is at stake," she fumed into the phone. After that, Donald took Tiffany to get vaccinated behind Marla's back. By the time Donald started campaigning for the 2016 election, he had been swayed more in Marla's direction. I am totally in favor of vaccines, but I want smaller doses over a longer period of time, he said in a Republican primary debate in 2015. We've had so many instances, people that work for me, in which a child, a beautiful child, went to have the vaccine and came back and a week later had a tremendous fever, got very, very sick, now is autistic. Donald grew frustrated by Marla's mother, Anne, who he told friends he found overbearing and always around, which she was. She doted on her daughter and her granddaughter and gave Marla some company, which she desperately needed since her husband was off working most of the time. Donald told people he felt like he had no space from his mother-in-law, who'd butt in and give her opinion when Donald just wanted a space. He told his friends that she was a mooch and that she needed to worry about her own life and get out of his. His work schedule weighed on Marla, too. Why can't you be home at 5 o'clock? Donald recalled her asking in The Art of the Comeback, a request Donald viewed as very selfish. On the flip side, Marla's acting career, which she tried to restart over and over again, with frequent trips to Los Angeles and auditions on both coasts, got under her husband's skin. He really has the desire to have me be more of a traditional wife, she said in an interview, an expectation he'd had with Ivana, too, once she started working for him in Atlantic City and at the Plaza. He definitely wants his dinner promptly served at 7, and if he's home at 6:30, it should be ready by 6:30. That Marla didn't trust her husband did not help matters. There were only so many golf games she could tag along to, especially with a little daughter in tow. Donald did little to reassure her that he changed, because the reality was he hadn't. He once took a New Yorker writer on a tour through Mar-a-Lago, stopping at its spa. He introduced the writer to the resident physician, a woman named Dr. Ginger Leah Southall, who'd recently graduated from a chiropractic college. Donald wasn't sure where she got her degree. Baywatch Medical School, he joked. Does that sound right? I'll tell you the truth. Once I saw Dr. Ginger's photograph, I didn't really need to look at her resume or anyone else's. Are you asking, did we hire her because she'd trained at Mount Sinai for 15 years? The answer is no, and I will tell you why, because by the time she spent 15 years at Mount Sinai, we don't want to look at her. A year and a half into their marriage, Marla had a dalliance of her own, which Donald never really forgave. The National Enquirer ran a story detailing how a cop caught Marla and her bodyguard, Spencer Wagner, who was more than 6 feet tall and 15 years younger than Donald, huddled behind a lifeguard stand in the middle of the night while her husband was back in New York. On April 16th at 4 o'clock in the morning, a police officer happened upon a car parked next to a stretch of beach 12 miles south of Mar-a-Lago. The way Marla tells it, she had been out to dinner in Fort Lauderdale with friends and then on to a jazz club. When they were headed back to the mansion, nature called. She couldn't make it the extra few minutes and instructed the bodyguard to pull over so she could relieve herself on an empty beach. The officer didn't see Marla initially when he walked onto the sand to investigate. Wagner insisted he was alone until the cops spotted Marla in spandex and a sports bra crouching behind the lifeguard chair. The Enquirer reported that she tried to sweet-talk the cop initially, saying there just had to be a way to make this go away. She resorted to pleading with him to not put her name over the police radio. He let them go with a couple parking tickets and a warning to get on home. Donald called the story garbage once it came out. Along the lines of Elvis sightings and Martian invasions, the National Enquirer has once again fabricated a wholly unreliable cover story for this week's issue, he said in a statement. But privately, he didn't trust Marla's story. The validity of what she told him, though, mattered less than a public perception that Marla was running around on him. It made him look like a cuckold, and that really disturbed him, a friend noted. Their relationship and everything was always supposed to be all about him, about how adored and wanted he was, and when it wasn't, he couldn't stand it. The simple fact of the matter was, they didn't much like each other. Everything they each were individually, the other wanted the opposite. They had nothing in common apart from their daughter, but the ultimate undoing of their marriage, as with all things related to Donald, came down to money. A few years into his marriage to Marla, Donald finally had some. By the mid-1990s, as Donald neared his 50th birthday, the Trump is back storyline started permeating newspapers and magazines. Forbes once again put him on its list of the 400 richest Americans in 1996, ranking him at number 376. He insisted that he was owed a position much higher up on the list, claiming that the $450 million that the magazine had estimated was about one-eighth of what he was actually worth. The remainder of the Welcome Back Donald stories were prompted in large part by a windfall Donald got from selling his interest in the Grand Hyatt Hotel, his first big splash in Manhattan, and the deal he had rushed back from his honeymoon with Ivana to close, to his business partners, the Pritzker family. The vast majority of what the Pritzkers paid him out went to people he owed and toward various commissions, but he nevertheless walked away with about $25 million. It was a novelty for Donald. He could tuck himself in his oversized bed in his Trump Tower triplex and doze off without the thought of creditors and debts and all the financial mires that had encumbered him year after year. Something else started weighing on him. The prenuptial agreement he'd convinced Marla to sign in 1993 guaranteed her somewhere in the range of $1 million to $5 million if they were to split up before their fifth wedding anniversary. After that, it would balloon into a sum many, many times that. The fixed amount that accounted for a portion of his fortune could become a large chunk of what he'd just got back. Once again, Donald was lucky with the timing of his marriage unraveling. With Ivana, the conflict in Aspen had unfolded when he was broke enough that Ivana couldn't push for more than she'd agreed to in their prenuptial agreement. And now he was fed up with Marla just a few months before the milestone that would guarantee her much more of what he had. I remember him pulling me aside in the lobby of Trump Tower one day and telling me all these reasons he was considering filing for divorce, one friend recalled, and I just looked him dead in the eye and told him to cut the crap. I knew it was about the money, and he knew he couldn't hide it from me. I just reminded him that he should do what he wanted, but he needed to do it with a little dignity this time. Marla had an idea of what was coming, though she tried to hide it as long as she could. She had just gotten off the wild ride that is a Trump divorce. She knew full well what she was about to face, and if she could head it off, she would. At the end of April 1997, Marla and her mother Anne and three-year-old Tiffany traveled back down to Dalton for a celebration in honor of her hometown's 150th birthday. Speaking at the Bridge Club in town, Marla brushed off her husband's obvious absence from the event. "He works all the time," she said, smiling at the curious women she'd left behind to live in that gilded triplex and sweeping oceanfront mansion. "That man." Less than a week later, she and Donald released a joint statement announcing their separation. "After a 3.5-year marriage, we have decided to separate as friends," the statement read. "For the sake of our family, we ask that the members of the media will accept this statement, respect our privacy, and move on to coverage of more important issues." The sentiment from a man who dipped his bride-to-be nearly a half dozen times in front of 100 flashbulbs at their wedding, who phoned in stories to court the press after his first divorce, dripped with irony. Although paparazzi started to stake out some of the exits in Trump Tower and flew helicopters over Mar-a-Lago, the coverage paled in comparison to that of divorce number one. Outwardly, there was no other man or woman in the picture, which made the separation far less delicious for gossip columnists from the get-go. There was no trail of affair breadcrumbs for them to follow, and no months of whispers about a looming split either. "I hadn't heard any rumors of a breakup," said Liz Smith, who chronicled Donald's split with Ivana down to the second. "I wish I had. It's a great story." Inherently, though, a second divorce is less great a story than a first, even if this particular second marriage was recorded as if it were a sordid royal courtship. The Trumps may have dominated headlines for weeks and months straight in the early 1990s, but no one is particularly shocked when the quintessential other woman becomes just another woman in Donald Trump's storied history of them. Stern called it, on their wedding night, no less. This relationship always had a shelf life, but with a young child in the picture, no one really reveled in the "I told you so" and karmic retribution of it all either. This did not mean the tabloids didn't extract whatever juice they could of the split. Donald wants out. He's looking for his freedom, the Post reported. Marla's Beverly Hillbillies family drove Donald crazy, one source told the paper. Another suggested that the whole breakup was all a ploy to get more eyeballs to tune in to the Miss Universe pageant, which Trump owned and was scheduled to air 2 weeks after the announcement. It took only a few days for the papers to cast new leads in Donald's romantic melodrama, including Dr. Ginger Southall, the Mar-a-Lago staff chiropractor he'd lauded for her fictitious degree from the Baywatch Medical School. "I've heard Sharon Stone's name mentioned," he boasted to his friends of the rumors. "I've heard Princess Di. It's wild." Like Ivana, Marla initially contested the prenup she'd begrudgingly signed to quash the little fear monster keeping Donald from agreeing to the M-word. She claimed she agreed to it under duress and extreme pressure, and it went against all the things her husband promised to provide her and her daughter in their 3-odd years of marriage. Neither Marla nor Donald showed up to the Manhattan Supreme Court hearing on July 8th of 1999. 2 years into a legal tug-of-war between the two sides. Trump's attorney had called the agreement ironclad and contended that Marla knew exactly what she was giving away and getting herself into when she signed it. Marla disagreed. "After giving Donald 2 years to honor the verbal commitments he made to me during our 12-year relationship, I decided to walk away completely under the terms of our prenuptial agreement that had been placed before me just 5 days before our 1993 wedding," she said in a statement. She was in Los Angeles at the time, once again auditioning all over town to land herself an acting gig. What she got after 2 years of fighting was something close to a reported $2 million, along with more support to take care of Tiffany. It wasn't nearly enough to keep up the lifestyle she and her 5-year-old had grown accustomed to. The way he saw it, that wasn't Donald's problem. In a statement of his own, he said that he was happy the split had worked out so amicably and that he wishes his now ex-wife well. Those well wishes came 10 months after Donald Trump spotted a 28-year-old Slovenian model in a Midtown nightclub whom he quickly turned into what his friends considered the next hot flavor of the month. Donald had already been dating 20-something models and socialites about town for months, barely taking a breather following his initial separation from Marla. He took out model Carrie Young for a time. Norwegian cosmetics heiress Selena Middelfart had made the rounds with him as well. She turned up with him to the Kit Kat Club, a joint on 43rd Street named after the club and the musical Cabaret, one night in September of 1998. It was the middle of Fashion Week, which meant the club was flush with more models than usual. Among them was Melania Knaus, who'd moved to New York 2 years earlier from Milan to see if she could make more money doing commercial work. Paolo Zampoli, an Italian-born businessman who owned ID Models at the time, met her at a casting call years earlier and secured an H-1B visa for her, typically reserved for high-skilled workers like engineers and computer whizzes with advanced degrees, but sometimes copped by models who have not even graduated from high school, let alone college. On the campaign trail, Donald would deride the use of such visas, calling out rampant, widespread H-1B abuse, saying that they are for temporary foreign workers imported from abroad for the explicit purpose of substituting for American workers at lower pay. She moved into an apartment in the Zeckendorf Towers near Union Square with a roommate and rent mostly footed by her agency. But work wasn't as easy to come by as Zampoli made it seem. She found more success in Paris and Milan before she moved to New York. In Manhattan, models a decade younger beat her out for the tobacco and alcohol ads she got called in for. She found some jobs doing ads for a watch company, some lingerie shoots, a Panasonic spot that aired on TV, and a billboard for Camel, which got mounted in the middle of Times Square, not far from the Kit Kat Club. Melania was toying with the idea of moving back to Europe as her bank account tipped toward empty when she went out in Midtown that September evening, which she typically did not do. Usually, she went to the movies or to the gym. Sometimes she spent an evening sewing clothes for herself in her apartment. She'd always been somewhat hermetic and studious growing up. She was born in Novo Mesto, what was then Yugoslavia, in 1970, and lived with her parents and sister in a communist apartment block in the riverside town of Zevnica. The family had more than most. Her mother, Amalia, worked developing patterns at a textile factory, and her father, Viktor Knops, a chauffeur for the mayor of a nearby town who later became a car salesman for a state-owned company. He allegedly was suspected of having evaded taxes when Melania was in elementary school, though his daughter has since denied the reports. When she was young, Viktor would spend weekends washing his antique Mercedes, a ritual he took great pleasure in, and Amalia would bring back fashion magazines from France and Germany where she traveled for work for her daughters to flip through. By the time Melania turned 22, she landed herself in a Slovenian magazine as part of an annual Look of the Year contest. The magazine promised that the top three women would get contracts in cities across Europe. Melania was furious when she was named runner-up. She later claimed to have won the competition, a small white lie that became one of a number of fibs she told of her upbringing. She changed her name, of course, from Melania Knavs, K-N-A-V-S, to Melania Knaus, K-N-A-U-S-S. She dropped out of the University of Ljubljana to move to Milan to model after a year. Though throughout the 2016 presidential campaign, her website still claimed she graduated with a degree in design and architecture. Despite the white lies, friends describe Melania as unfailingly sweet and unwilling to look for any kind of trouble. In an interview with author Charlotte Hayes, one former model friend likened Melania to strawberry ice cream. Sweet, she said, and smells nice. She hardly dated, hardly went to bars or clubs, but Zampoli was throwing the Kit Kat Club party, and his parties were a thing of legend at that point. He'd bring in tiger cubs and fashion television cameras and once an alligator, and men like Donald Trump who'd come with one blonde and leave lusting after another. That night, when Middlefart got up to go to the ladies' room, he moved toward Melania. "I went crazy," he later told Larry King in an interview about seeing her for the first time. "There was this great supermodel sitting next to Melania. I was supposed to meet the supermodel, but I said, forget about her, what about the one to the left?" The one to the left had a vague sense of who Donald was. He was rich and well-known, but anyone with any sort of gut sense could tell that by looking at the way he carried himself. "I had my life, I had my world," she later said of their introduction. "I didn't follow Donald Trump and what kind of life he had." The legend they like to tell is that when Donald asked for Melania's number, she suggested she take his instead. "It was a test," she says. "If he gave her his office line, she'd know he wasn't for real." She had no interest in doing business with him, though ultimately that is what all of Donald's relationships, romantic or otherwise, become: transactional. He gave her his office line, along with his home phone for the triplex and his number at Mar-a-Lago. Melania told friends she had no interest in Donald, especially knowing he'd cozied up to her after coming to the party with another woman. Zampoli's girlfriend at the time, a Hungarian model who lived in the same apartment building as Melania, told reporters that she was turned off by the whole thing and that the idea of her friend actually calling Donald was absolutely out of the question. She did call, though, after she went on a photo shoot in the Caribbean and came back to New York. Donald took her on a date to Mumba, the downtown club of the moment, and soon after, on his jet down to Mar-a-Lago for the weekend. It didn't take long for Donald to introduce her to his children, who are older now and less stung by this relationship than they had been with Marla. Melania hadn't come between their parents, nor was she the first, second, or tenth pretty young thing they'd seen him with around town. "It was much more difficult getting along with my dad's girlfriends when I was younger, because almost every woman who came into the house was somehow a challenge to me," Ivanka admitted to gossip columnist Chauncey Hayden years later. That she and her brothers could see how plainly they were after her dad's money also didn't sit well, coupled with the fact that they tended to be half Donald's age. "As long as his girlfriends never get any younger than my oldest brother, then it's fine," Ivanka joked in an interview with the Mail on Sunday, adding that with Don Jr. getting into his 20s at the time, it's starting to cut down his options. The only thing that bothered her about her dad dating younger women was that she could so clearly see their intentions. There was one girl he was seeing, and I knew she wasn't a good person and was just after his money, so I said it to her face on several occasions, she said in the interview, adding that she managed to get rid of her, though they still ran into one another because they were both modeling at the time. Ivanka didn't worry about gold digging as much with Melania. She could tell she had a good character, and she'd known her father long enough now that she would have left if it were just about the money. Dad's too much of a pain in the ass to stick around with for too long if your motives aren't genuine. Plus, she added, you can be a money grabber at 45, so if that's your real problem, then age doesn't matter. Melania sat rows behind the children and Ivana in the marble collegiate church when Donald's father Fred passed away in June 1999, where Mayor Rudolph Giuliani eulogized him, and the likes of Joan Rivers and Al D'Amato sat in the pews. Paparazzi caught Melania in a low-cut, lacy black slip dress barely covered up by a black cardigan and a silver cross around her neck, leaving the church alone. Marla did not attend the ceremony in the church in which she'd secretly meet Donald with the reverend who'd married them half a dozen years earlier. 10 days after the funeral, their divorce was finalized. That's about the time that Donald started toying with the idea of running for president as a member of the Reform Party. It was serious enough that he let Chris Matthews interview him live in front of 1,200 students that November for an episode of Hardball taped at the University of Pennsylvania where both men had spent their undergraduate years. Matthews opened with a question asking Donald what life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness meant to him. Donald immediately brought up people who were going to do great things in the world and pointed to his own son, Don Jr., in the audience. Matthews urged him to tell his son to stand up for the cameras. He's much better looking than I am, Donald joked. Matthews mentioned that he had another special guest in the audience. My supermodel, Donald said, smiling. Where's my supermodel, Melania? That's Melania Knaus. Stand up, he ordered. She did, cameras catching the whole thing. One thing that's safe to say about you, Donald, is that you know the difference between Slovakia and Slovenia, Matthews teased. I do, Donald mused. I do, absolutely. As Donald mulled what came next for his political future, he nudged Melania forward in her career. He was keen on his girlfriend posing for a photo shoot in the January issue of British GQ, a special edition emblazoned Naked Supermodel Special on its cover, alongside a cover line reading, Sex at 30,000 feet, Melania Knaus earns her air miles. Donald lent them his Boeing jet, which was parked at LaGuardia Airport in Queens for the shoot. The concept was to make Melania into a sort of Bond girl meets could-be first lady. As the story accompanying the photos suggestively said, Melania is an expert in the art of in-flight entertainment, and as his personal hostess, she might just end up as the next first lady. It continued, Miss Canales is relishing the prospect of a future pressing the flesh on state occasions. I will put all my effort into it, and I will support my man. Melania showed her support in the nude, or barely covered. In one photo, she splays out completely naked, apart from a diamond choker and thick diamond bangles on each wrist, on a tan fur blanket where she is handcuffed to a locked briefcase. In another, she digs into the briefcase, which is filled with more diamond bracelets, spilling out of the gold sequin negligee that just barely remains tied on. In one shot, she stands on the wing of the plane in a bright red python print push-up bra, matching thong and black knee-high boots, pointing both her bare backside and a silver pistol in the direction of the camera. She also posed, sitting with her legs spread on the captain's chair in the cockpit, a silver chain-link bodysuit barely hiding her chest, but a silver headpiece covering most of her head. In all of the photos, what she lacks in clothing, she makes up for in avant-garde eyewear. It was not exactly a traditional spread for a potential first lady, though it did presage the unconventional nature of the role she'd unwittingly fall into 17 years later. Donald was not on set the day of the shoot, but he insisted on the photos being delivered to his office. The magazine framed the cover and a few other shots and sent them his way as quickly as it could. Friends remember that he could not have been more thrilled to have his girlfriend looking the way she did in a photo shoot in a major magazine. It was his dream come true to have her looking like that, getting more and more famous, one friend remembered. This was a man who constantly boasted about his ability to make stars out of both Ivana and Marla, even if the attention was often of the negative variety. Even still, the pair broke up around the time the issue hit newsstands. On January 11th, 2000, The Post ran a story under the headline, "Trump Nixes Knaus." As the tabloid reported, Donald thought Melania was great, but the same little fear monster that had reared its head once he divorced Ivana for Marla appeared again. Donald has to be free for a while. He didn't want to get hooked, a source told The Post. He was still reeling from his split from Marla, and he needed companionship. And then Melania came along, and she was beautiful and available. As the paper told it, she was also now completely and utterly heartsick. 2 days later, Donald posed for cameras at 151, a club in Midtown at which he was throwing a party for his Miss USA pageant. Asked about the split, he told reporters, "Melania is an amazing woman, a terrific woman, a great woman, and she will be missed." Melania's friends told the story of their breakup differently. She, like Marla, didn't trust him. He was up to his old ways, and she wasn't going to have it. She got over it soon enough, and he did not miss her for long, because the pair got back together a few months later. Melania retreated further into his world, away from her friends and deeper into the sinkhole that could swallow anyone close to Trump. She had not been back to visit her parents until the summer of 2002 when, after a stop in London, Donald and Melania took his plane to Slovenia, where a pair of black Mercedes and both of her parents awaited their arrival. They landed in time for late dinner, for which they drove a half hour from the airport to the Grand Hotel Toplice, where they were seated at a table overlooking Lake Bled. Melania had to translate everything. Donald, of course, did not speak Slovenian, and her parents did not speak English well. Melania, on the other hand, spoke five languages. The whole trip lasted only a few hours. It was enough for Donald. They boarded the plane back out of town a few hours after they touched down. "I was there for about 15 minutes," he told Larry King of the visit a few years later, laughing at the abrupt nature of it. "A beautiful country," he added. "I landed, said, 'Hi, Mom, hi, Dad, bye.'" In the winter and spring of 2004, The Apprentice premiered on NBC. Donald often showed off his girlfriend. When he brought contestants up to tour his triplex, when winners of a contest got to dine with the couple at his father's table at the 21 Club, in the finale, when they took a helicopter to the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, a contestant mispronounced her name, and in the entirety of the hour-long episode, she said six words. "It's so cute. It's really cute." 2 weeks after the finale aired, to record ratings, at the end of April, Donald proposed to Melania. It was 5.5 years after they first met at the Kit Kat Club, and his third official proposal. By that point, he knew what he was doing. He surprised Melania before he left to attend the annual Costume Institute Gala at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the coveted event attended by megawatt stars and fashion insiders that takes place the first Monday in May each year. It was the first time Melania had scored an invitation, and she would arrive with a 15-carat emerald-cut stone with tapered diamond baguettes on each side, all set in platinum. When she showed up to the event, the ring sparkled against the black strapless corseted dress she chose to go along with that year's theme, aptly dangerous liaisons, as she posed with her soon-to-be stepdaughter Ivanka, who wore a peach silken lace slip dress on the carpet. No one much noticed at the gala. The next day, they shared the news with The Post, "How Trump Iced the Deal, $2 million sparkler for his fiancée," the headline read. "It was a great surprise," Melania told the tabloid. "We are very happy together." Donald later told Larry King that they were together for 5 years and literally never had an argument. "I said, you know what? It's time. It's time." The Post headline got something slightly off. Donald later told the Times that the truth was he paid half as much. Graff Diamonds, Oprah Winfrey's jeweler, he reminded King, had offered him a steep discount. "Only a fool would say, 'No, thank you, I want to pay $1 million more for a diamond.'" The deal paid off for the London-based jeweler, which noted an uptick in its stores from all the publicity Melania's ring received when news of their engagement broke. In early 2018, Graff's chairman told Forbes that Donald was given no such favors. Donald's previous marriages had been all about money in their own ways. Ivana had threatened to bleed him dry by fighting their premarital agreement, though at the time, he had no blood to give. Marla was around while he made something of a fortune back, but fought him for years for a larger portion of it than she'd agreed to in their prenuptial agreement. As for the ceremony and receptions themselves, Donald had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, to entertain guests who didn't truly care for the newlyweds or the idea of watching them say their vows or cut into their cakes under canopies of imported white flowers. In his third go-around, Donald, of course, again demanded a prenuptial agreement, but this time he figured out a way to make the wedding about money coming into him rather than flowing out. After he said he took the special price from Graff, and Graff in turn made it back so quickly, other wedding vendors raced to cash in on the latest Trump nuptial spectacular. Once the couple had decided to wed in Palm Beach, the offers started rolling in. Donald told the Times he'd turned down offers from a handful of high-end florists who'd offered to flood the Versailles-like ballroom in Mar-a-Lago with a cascade of whatever flowers the couple envisioned for their day. A half dozen top chefs raised their hands to prepare the dinner that evening. One private jet company agreed to hand out glasses of champagne to those who arrived at the airport for the wedding, and another company said they would be more than happy to provide a grand fireworks display gratis during the reception. Lest he risk turning into Star Jones, the former host of The View who'd turned her wedding into a freebie wonderland and earned herself the moniker Bridezilla, Donald turned down the fireworks, and Melania nixed the idea of having the whole thing filmed and televised for all the world to see. Literally anything you can imagine, from photos to flowers to food to jets to airports to diamonds, Mr. Trump told the paper. And for every item, there's five people who want to do it. In all cases, they don't want anything, but they want the recognition. Initially, both Donald and Melania contended, at least publicly, that they wanted the wedding to be small and simple. "Who needs a big hoopla? I get enough of it," Donald said to Us Weekly. "I like private and intimate," Melania told People. This was Donald's third, after all, and the first two had been such big to-dos, with hundreds of people and thousands of flashbulbs, honking big wedding cakes, elaborate gowns, crystals and caviar, and critics nastily gossiping about the couple barely out of their earshot. But it was Melania's first wedding, and so many things were going to be free this go-around. His kids would be there this time, too. "I'm so excited for my dad," Ivanka told the Palm Beach Post about the upcoming wedding. "When he's happy, I'm happy," she said to Chauncey Hayden. Donald also had a show to promote. He was now a national household name as opposed to just a tabloid regular. This wedding, if he did it right, wouldn't be just a gossip brag sensation like the last two. It could be an American royal wedding on the cover of the most regarded magazines and talked about the world over. It would feed his ego, sure, but it would also line his pockets. You can't pay for that kind of publicity, particularly one that branded him as a 58-year-old, landing a stunning model 24 years his junior in a lavish affair fit for a king. As soon as that thought dawned on him, small and simple dissolved in an instant. Big hoopla it would be. This time around, Donald had time to send out proper invitations, engraved from Tiffany's. They requested the honor of the presence of hundreds of famous friends and acquaintances, and anyone with a name fit for a public guest list they'd ever come across at the Episcopal Church of Bethesda by the Sea, where they would participate in a traditional wedding ceremony, and a reception to follow at Mar-a-Lago on January 22, 2006. While in his first wedding, Donald and his assistants planned the whole thing while Ivana got her footing in New York. Now, Melania had a hand in every detail. On the night of the wedding, in fact, a New Yorker reporter overheard Donald in a men's room during the reception telling someone that it was time to make an honest woman out of Melania, and this night was her night, not his. For all the A-listers who'd turned down an invite to Donald's wedding to Marla in New York, they sure did file into Palm Beach to bear witness to lucky number three. Just around 7 p.m. on January 22nd, they made their way into the pews at the Episcopal Church of Bethesda by the Sea, breathing in the gardenias and roses that dozens of refrigerated trucks had driven from New York to Florida for the affair. There were politicians, Hillary and Bill Clinton, Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, George Pataki, Steve Wynn. There were those from the sports world, Derek Jeter, Shaquille O'Neal, Don King. There were those in the music universe, Billy Joel, P. Diddy, Paul Anka, Usher, Simon Cowell. And there were media heavy hitters, Jeff Zucker, Barbara Walters, Katie Couric, Matt Lauer, Kelly Ripa, Chris Matthews, Kathy Lee Gifford, Les Moonves. If someone had dropped a bomb on that place, it would have wiped out an entire generation of famous Americans, the band leader's wife told a reporter. Tiffany had handed out all of her programs before she took a seat beside her half-sister. Don Jr. and Eric took their places at the altar. A soloist from the Metropolitan Opera, in fact, the same soloist who had performed at Donald's second wedding, began singing Ave Maria after Donald joined his sons in front of the Gothic-looking church, lit by gleaming lanterns hanging from the pointed ceiling. The doors at the back of the church swung open, and Melania walked through. Or, she tried to walk through. She hadn't practiced moving around in her gown, which likely weighed more than half as much as she did. It would have taken her down in front of all those famous guests staring directly at her had it not been for a few quick-on-their-feet minders who steadied the bride and sent her on down the aisle. She didn't stop when a guest's cell phone rang from the pews. She fixed her eyes on her soon-to-be husband, who looked almost humbled, if not by the woman he was about to marry, then by all the genuine stars who had turned up to watch the woman he was about to marry say her first I do's. Melania carried a set of rosaries that had long belonged to her family, and as part of the traditional ceremony, the couple lit a candle she had asked her mother to bring from Slovenia. She'd only lit it once before, at her baptism decades earlier. Ivanka read from the Bible, Donald and Melania exchanged their vows, and their guests broke into a round of applause and rowdy cheers, throwing white rose petals in the air. Whereas Donald had only offered Marla a peck on the cheek at the conclusion of their ceremony, he kissed his newest wife a hearty 3 times in a row. It was quick, but beautiful and perfect, Cowell told a reporter afterward. I give it a 9. About 100 limousine drivers were on hand to transport guests back to Mar-a-Lago for the reception, where 45 chefs were at work preparing mountains of caviar and hors d'oeuvres covered in edible gold leaf. Both Eric and Don Jr. offered toasts to their father and new stepmother. I know this is the last time I'll ever have to stand up here, Eric said. I look forward to spending many years annoying both of you, Donnie joked. Donald gave a toast of his own, telling the crowd that his years with Melania had been the best 6 years of my life in every way. Unquestionably, one of those ways was that they happened to be the years in which he had become a figure of enviable outward success and status. Billy Joel, Paul Anka, and Tony Bennett serenaded the crowd before the couple cut into their cake after midnight. It was a 70-inch, 7-tiered, golden-white classic yellow sponge cake flavored with sprinkled zest, soaked with Grand Marnier, filled with buttercream, and covered with 2,000 sugar flowers. The whole thing weighed 200 pounds and was held together inside all that butter, sugar, flour, by an intricate construction of hidden internal wires. So intricate, in fact, that it couldn't actually be cut into enough pieces to serve the hundreds of guests. They baked a bunch of backup cakes to serve instead, and Mar-a-Lago staffers dug into the real cake after the party was over. The party itself went well into the evening. Melania changed into a second dress, a far lighter Vera Wang ruche silk tulle gown with a slit well up her knees, the whole thing hugging close to her body. A DJ played by the pool for guests to dance until Donald carried his third wife into his suite in his club at around 4 o'clock in the morning. The couple stayed at Mar-a-Lago for their honeymoon. Why are we going to leave our beautiful house and venture out to some tropical island where things aren't clean? He explained to Larry King a few months after the wedding. Melania took to the role of being the third Mrs. Trump immediately. By April, she chaired the Martha Graham Dance Company's season-opening fundraising gala at Tavern on the Green, to which she showed up in a strapless cream Dior gown embroidered with little pastel flowers and cut on an umpire waist. It was an uncharacteristically flowy silhouette for the model, which immediately sent the gossip mill churning out rumors that she'd chosen the looser dress